"Mr. Ferris, let us establish a watch," Lawrence said. "And now that we have all been rested, we will go to work in shifts. I should like to see a more efficient job of it."
A quarter of an hour seemed long enough inside that damp, dark space beneath, with only the narrow crack of white light at one end. Besides the mushrooms themselves, there was a grassy stink, very like damp manure throughout, and a sour smell of fresh vomit which they had themselves added to the atmosphere. Where they had already cleared the mushrooms, the earth was strangely springy underfoot, almost matted, not like dirt at all. Lawrence staggered out again into the fresh air, gratefully, with his arms full.
"Captain!"
Dorset said, following him out. He was not carrying a mushroom, and when Lawrence had deposited his armload before the newly organized sorters, Dorset showed him a torn-edged square of matted grass and muck, the flooring of the cave. Lawrence gazed at it uncomprehendingly.
"It is elephant dung," Dorset said, breaking apart the chunk, "and dragon also."
"Wing, 2 points west of north!"
Emily Rowland's treble voice rang out high and sharp before Lawrence had fully understood. At once all was a confused hurrying into the shelter of the cave. He looked for Reverend Erasmus and the children, but before he could be herded inside the cave, De Manet, with one quick look at the oncoming dragon, snatched his brother up bodily from the ground and ran instead away into the underbrush, the dog dashing off after them. Its barking came back twice at increasing distances, and then cut off into a muzzled whine.
"Leave the mushrooms! Take the guns!"
Lawrence cupped his hands over his mouth to roar over the commotion. He snatched up his own sword and pistols, put aside to help with the carrying, and gave Mrs. Erasmus his hand to descend into the cavern, past the riflemen already crouched down by the door. Shortly the rest of them were crammed in also, all of them jostling involuntarily to keep as near the entrance and its fresh air as they could, until the dragon landed with an earth-trembling heavy thud, and thrust his muzzle directly up against the opening. It was the self-same ferrel, dark red-brown, with the queer ivory tusks in his muzzle. The hot, queasy kerosene smell of dragon breath came in upon them as he roared furiously, and the faint undertaste of rot from old meals.
"Hold fast, men!"
Riggs was yelling by the entrance.
"Hold fast! Wait for it!"
until the dragon shifted his position, his open jaws before them, and the volley went off into the soft flesh of its mouth. The dragon squalled in fury and jerked back. His talons came scrabbling in at the edges of the hole, too large to come all the way inside, and began to pull and claw at the rock. Small pebbles and stones worked loose. Dirt rained down upon them from the ceiling. Lawrence looked around for Mrs. Erasmus. She was silent and only bracing herself against the wall of the cavern for steadiness, her shoulders rigid. The riflemen were coughing as they reloaded urgently, but the dragon had already learnt and did not present them another target. Its claws came curling in on both sides of the fissure, and then it began to throw its weight back until all the chamber trembled and groaned. Lawrence drew his sword and leaped forward to hack at the talons, then to stab, the hard scaly flesh resisting the edge but not the point. Warren was beside him, and Ferris in the dark. The dragon roared again outside and flexed its talons, blindly knocking them down as easily as gnats might be swatted. The hard, polished, bony curve of one claw slid across Lawrence's coat in a line over the belly, thrusting him hard against the matted cavern floor, and the tip caught and pulled a long green thread from the seam as the talons withdrew again from the fissure. Warren caught Lawrence by the arm, and together they staggered back from the entry. The gunpowder smoke was bitter and acrid, overlaid on the rotting sweet stink of the mushrooms. Already Lawrence could scarcely breathe for the slaughterhouse thickness of the place, and he heard to all sides men heaving like the lower decks of a ship in a roaring gale. The feral did not immediately renew the attack. They cautiously crept forward again to peer out. He had settled himself in the clearing outside. By bad luck, far back enough to be out of firing range of their rifles, and his pale yellow-green eyes were fixed malevolently upon the fissure. He was licking at his hacked-about talons and making grimaces with his mouth, pulling his lips back from his serrated teeth and forward again, spitting occasionally a little bit of blood upon the ground, but plainly he had taken no great harm. As they watched, he raised his head up and roared again thunderously in anger.
"Sir, we might put gunpowder in a bottle,"
his gunner Calloway said, crawling over to Lawrence.
"Or the flash powder, maybe, will give him a start. I have the sack here." "'We're not going to frighten that beauty away with a little flash and bang, not for long,' Chenery said, craning his head back and forth to study their enemy. "'My God! 15 tons at least, or I miss my guess. 15 tons! In a feral!'
"'I would call it closer to 20, and damned unfortunate, too,' Warren said.
"'We had better save what you have, Mr. Calloway,' Lawrence said to the gunner. "'It will do us no good, only to startle him away briefly. We must wait until the dragons return and reserve our fire to give them support.'
"'Oh, Christ! If Natidus or Dulcia are the first back,' Warren said, and did not need to continue. The little dragons would certainly be frantic and wholly overmatched. "'No, they will all be loaded down, remember?' Harcourt said. "'The weight will tell on the lightweights more and keep them back. But however are they to fight when they get here?'
"'Lord, let us not be borrowing trouble, if you please,' Chenery interrupted. "'That big fellow is no trained flyer.' A nice thing if 4 dragons of the core couldn't black his eye in a trice, even if Missoria and Immortalis don't come along. We have only to keep quiet in here until they come.
Captain, Dorset said, stumbling back towards them, I beg to recall your attention. The floor of the cavern.
Yes, Lawrence said,
recalling the earlier sample which Dorset had shown him of the dung upon the floor of the cave, elephant and dragon, where neither animal could have managed entry.
"'Do you mean there is another way into this cavern somewhere, where it should come in upon us?'
"'No, no,' Dorset said. "'The dung has been spread. Deliberately,' he added, seeing their confusion. "'These are cultivated.'
"'What? Do you mean men, farming the things?' Chenery said. "'What the devil would a person want with the nasty stuff?'
"'Did you say there was dragon dung?' Lawrence said.
And a shadow falling over the mouth of the cave drew their attention outside. 2 more dragons landing, smaller creatures but sleek, wearing harness made of ropes, and 12 men armed with assegai, leaping down off their sides. The new arrivals all stayed well out of rifle range, conferring. After a little while, one of them came towards the entrance cautiously and shouted something in at them. Lawrence looked at Erasmus, who shook his head uncomprehending, and turned to his wife. She was staring out the door. She had her handkerchief pressed over her mouth and nostrils to hold out the smell, but she lowered it and, edging a little closer, called back, haltingly,
"'They said to come out, I think.'
"'Oh, certainly,' Chenery was rubbing his face against his sleeve. Some grit had entered his eyes. "'I'm sure they would like it of all things. You may tell them to—'
"'Gentlemen,'
Lawrence said, breaking in hastily, since Chenery had evidently forgotten his audience.
"'These are no ferals at all, plainly, but under harness.' And if we have trespassed upon the cultivated grounds of these men, we are in the wrong. We ought make amends if we can.
What a wretched mischance, Harcourt said, agreeing. We should have been perfectly happy to pay for the damned things after all. Ma'am, will you come out and speak to them with us? We should, of course, understand if you do not wish it, she added to Mrs. Erasmus.
A moment, Warren said, low and cautiously, catching at Harcourt's sleeve. Let us remember that we have never heard of anyone coming through the interior. Couriers have been lost, and expeditions. And how many settlements have we heard tell of, destroyed, in just this region north of the Cape? If the dragons are not feral, then these men have been responsible, viciously responsible. We are not to rely on their character.
Mrs. Erasmus looked at her husband.
He said, If we do not conciliate them— There will surely be battle when your dragons come back, for they will attack in fear for your safety. It is our Christian duty to make peace, if it can be done.
And she nodded and said softly,
I will go.
I believe I am senior, gentlemen, Warren said, as our dragons are not here.
A specious claim, as precedence in the corps went by dragon rank regardless, with no such qualifier involved outside flag rank. Coming from the Navy, with its rigid adherence to seniority, Lawrence had often found the system confusing, if not outright maddening. But it was a pragmatic concession to reality. The dragons had their own native hierarchies, and in nature the 20-year-old handler of a regal copper had more authority on the battlefield over the instinctive obedience of other dragons than did a 30-year veteran on the back of a Winchester.
"'Pray, let us have no nonsense,'
Harcourt began impatiently, when her first Lieutenant Hobbs broke in to say,
"'It is all a hum. You shan't go at all, none of you, and you ought know better,'
a little reproachfully.
"'Myself and Lieutenant Ferris shall escort the parson and his lady with their permission, and if all goes well we will try and bring one of the fellows back here to speak with you.'
Lawrence could not like the arrangement in the least, but for its keeping Catherine out of harm's way, but the other captains looked guilty and did not argue. They cleared back from the entrance, the riflemen covering the open ground from either side. Mrs. Erasmus cupped her hands over her mouth and called a warning, then Hobbs and Ferris stepped out one after another, cautiously, each with a pistol held muzzle down and ready, swords loosened on their belts. The strangers had stood back again, spears held lightly, the tips pointing towards the ground, but gripped, ready to pull back and let fly. They were tall men, all of them, with close-cropped heads and very dark colouring, skin so deep black it had almost a bluish cast in the sunlight. They were dressed very scantily, in loincloths of a remarkable deep purple, decorated in a running fringe with what looked like gold beads, and wore thin, laced leather sandals, which left the tops of their feet bare and rose to mid-thigh. They did not move to attack, and when Hobbs turned and beckoned, Reverend Erasmus climbed out of the cave and gave his wife his hand to assist her. They joined the lieutenants, and Mrs. Erasmus began speaking, slowly and clearly. She had taken a mushroom from the cave and held it out to them to show. The red-brown dragon stooped suddenly, its head bending towards her, and spoke. She looked directly up at him, startled but not visibly afraid, and it jerked its head back with an ugly, squawking cry, not a roar or a growl, wholly unlike any sound Lawrence had ever heard from a dragon's throat. One of the men reached out and, catching her by the arm, drew her towards him. His other hand pressed her forehead backwards, bending her neck in an awkward, exposed curve, and his hand pushed her hair away from her face, where the scar and the tattoo marred her forehead. Erasmus sprang forward, and Hobbs on his other side to pull her free. The man let her go without resistance, and took a step towards Erasmus, speaking low and rapidly, pointing at her. Ferris caught her in his arms as she fell back, shaking, supporting her. Erasmus spread his hands, placating, continuing to speak, even while he carefully sought to interpose himself before her. He was plainly not understood. He shook his head and tried again, in the coy language. This was not understood either. At last he tried another, haltingly, and tapping his own chest, said, "Londa!" The dragon snarled, and with no other warning the man took up his spear and drove it directly through Erasmus's body in one unbroken and terrible motion. Hobbs fired. The man fell. Erasmus also went toppling to his knees. He had an expression of only mild surprise on his face. His hand was on the spear haft, protruding from just above his breastbone. Mrs. Erasmus gave a single, hoarse cry of horror. He turned his head a little in her direction, tried to lift his hand towards her. It fell, limply, and he dropped to the ground. Ferris half-carried, half-dragged Mrs. Erasmus back towards the cave, the red-brown dragon lunging after them. Hobbs went down in spraying blood under that raking claw. Then Ferris was pushing Mrs. Erasmus into the cavern, backing her into their waiting arms just as the dragon flung itself at the entrance again, roaring at a wild, shrieking pitch, its talons scrabbling madly at the opening and shaking all the hollow hill. Lawrence caught Ferris by the arm as he fell stumbling backwards from the impact, blood in a thin streak crossing his shirt and face. Harcourt and Warren had Mrs. Erasmus.
"Mr. Riggs!" Lawrence shouted over the rattling din outside. "A little fire! And Mr. Calloway, let us have those flares, if you please!"
They gave the dragon another volley and a blue light straight into the face, which at least made it recoil momentarily. The two smaller dragons leapt into the breach and made an effort to herd the larger one back from the cavern, speaking to it in shrill voices, and at last it drew away again, its sides heaving, and dropped back into its crouch at the far end of the clearing.
"Mr. Turner, do you have the time?"
Lawrence asked his signal officer, coughing. The clouds from the flare were not dying away.
"I'm sorry, sir, I forgot to turn the glass for a while," the ensign said unhappily, "but it is past 4 in the afternoon watch."
Temera and Lily had not left until past 1, a 4 hours' flight in either direction, and a great deal of labour and packing to be done in Cape Town before they would even begin the return journey.
"We must try and get a little sleep by watches,"
Lawrence said quietly to Harcourt and Warren. Dorset had taken charge of Mrs. Erasmus and guided her deeper into the cave.
"We can hold them at the fissure, I think, but we must stay vigilant."
"Sir," Emily Rowland said, "beg pardon, sir, but Mr. Dorset says to tell you there is smoke coming into the cave from the back."
A narrow vent at the back, higher up than they could reach. Propped up on Mr. Pratt's broad shoulder, Lawrence could see, through the thin stream of black smoke, the orange glow of the fire which the men had set to smoke them out. He dropped back to his own feet and cleared out of the way. Fellows and Laring, Harcourt's ground crew master, were trying together with their men to block the vent with scraps of harness and leather, using their own coats and shirts besides. They were having little success, and time worked against them. Already the cavern was nearly unbreathable, and the rising heat only worsened the natural stench.
"We cannot last long this way,"
Catherine said, hoarse but steady, when Lawrence had come back to the front of the cave.
"I think we had better make a dash for it while we still can, and try and lose them in the forest."
Outside the entrance, the thorny brush which they had torn up to make their camp was now being heaped up closer by the dragons, forming stacks higher than a man's head all around the cavern mouth, and the dragons had arranged themselves carefully behind this barrier, screened from rifle fire and blocking their avenues of escape. There would be precious little hope of breaking through, but no better alternative would offer itself.
"My crew is the largest," Lawrence said, "and we have 8 rifles. I hope you will all agree we should make the first attempt, and the rest of you come upon our heels. Mr. Dorset, perhaps you will be so kind as to wait with Mrs. Erasmus until we have cleared a little way, and I am sure Mr. Pratt will assist you," he added.
The order of emergence was settled upon in haste. They agreed upon a rendezvous point in the woods, consulting their compasses. Lawrence felt his neckcloth to be sure it was tied, and shrugged back into his coat in the dark, adjusting the gold bars upon his shoulders. His hat was gone.
"Warren, Chenery, your servant, Harcourt," he said, shaking their hands.
Ferris and Riggs were crouched by the opening, ready. His own pistols were loaded.
"Gentlemen," he said,
and drawing his sword, went through the cavern exit, a roar of "God and King George" behind him. Chapter 10 Lawrence stumbled as the rough hands dragged him up. His legs would not answer, and when he was flung forward they crumpled at once, casting him full length on the ground beside the other prisoners. They were being flung roughly into a rig much like their own belly netting, but of coarser rope and designed less for passengers than for baggage. In a few sharp jerks they were hauled up and slung below the red-brown dragon's belly, their arms and legs left to dangle through the large, haphazardly knotted gaps, and their bodies crammed in one atop another. The netting was loose, and swung in great sickening curves with every shift in the wind or direction, every sudden diving movement. There was no guard set to watch them, nor any personal restraint, but they were thoroughly immobilized regardless, and had no opportunity to shift their positions or converse. He was low in the netting, with his face pressed directly into the raw cords, which scraped him now and again. But he was grateful for the air despite the thin ribbons of blood which came dripping past him, and the wider arc of swinging. Dyer was pushed up against his side. Lawrence had his arm around the boy to keep him in. The netting was uneven, and the cords moving might have easily let him slip through to plunge to his death. The wounded had been thrown in with the hole. A young midwingman from Chenery's crew, badly clawed, lay with his jaw pressed against Lawrence's arm, blood seeping slowly from the corner of his mouth and soaking through the cloth. Sometime during the night he died, and his corpse stiffened slowly as they flew on. Lawrence could distinguish no one else around him, only the anonymous pressure of a boot in the small of his back, a knee jammed up against his own so that his leg was bent back upon itself. He had glimpsed Mrs. Erasmus only briefly in the dreadful confusion of their taking, as the nets were flung down upon them from the trees. She had certainly been dragged away alive. He did not wish to think on it. He could do little else, and Catherine's fate weighed on him heavily. They did not stop. He slept, or at least passed into a state more distant from the world than wakefulness, the wind passing over his face in gusts, the rocking of the netting not wholly unlike the querulous motion of a ship riding at anchor in a choppy cross-sea. A little while after dawn, the dragon brought up sharp, cupping the wind in its wings as it descended, bird-like, and came to the ground jarringly, skipping a few steps along the earth before dropping onto its forelegs. The netting was cut loose, roughly, and they were picked over quickly and efficiently, the men prodding them with the butt-ends of their spears and heaving away the corpses. Lawrence could not have risen to his legs with all the liberty in the world to do so, his knee afire with returning blood, but he raised his head and saw Catherine lying a little way distant, flat upon her back, pale and her eyes shut, with blood on the side of her face. There were two bloody rents in her coat also, near the arm, but she had kept it, and buttoned. Her hair was still tightly plaited, and there was no sign she had been distinguished. No time for anything more. A little water was splashed in their faces, and the netting folded back over their heads. The dragon stepped over them, and they were hoisted back up with quick, jerking pulls. Away again. The motion was worse in daylight, and they were a lighter load now, swaying more easily with the wind and every slight change of direction. The core was a service that hardened the stomach, but even so filth trickled down now through the press of bodies, the sour smell of bile. Lawrence breathed through his mouth so far as he could, and turned his face to the ropes when he himself had to vomit. There was no more sleep. Until at last, with the sun, they descended again, and this time at last they were taken out from the netting one and two at a time, weak and ill, and lashed together at wrists, upper arms, and ankles into a human chain. They were fixed to a pair of trees at either end, and their captors came around with water in dripping leather bags, fresh and delicious, the spout dragged too soon away from their seeking mouths. Lawrence held the last swallow on his parched tongue as long as he could. He leaned forward and glanced down the line. He did not see Warren at all, but Harcourt looked up at him, a quick nod. Ferris and Riggs looked as well as could be expected, and Roland was tied on at the very end, her head drooping against the tree to which she was fastened. Chenery was tied the other side of Dyer from him. His head was tipped awkwardly onto his own shoulder. His mouth hung open in exhaustion. He had a great purpling bruise all across his face, and he had his hand clenched upon his thigh as though the older wound pained him. They were near the banks of a river, Lawrence gradually became aware, hearing the slow, soft gurgling of the water behind him, though he could not turn about to look. A torment, when they were all still thirsty. They were in a matted, grassy clearing. Sending his eyes to the side, he could see a border of large stones encircling the flattened grounds, and a fire pit blackened with use. A hunting camp, perhaps, used regularly. The men were walking around the boundary, tearing up the greenery which had sent encroaching tendrils into the clearing. The great red-brown beast settled itself at the far side of the fire-pit, and closing its eyes down to slits, went to sleep. The other two took wing again, a mottled green and a dark brown creature, both with pale grey underbellies, gilded with a kind of iridescence, which quickly made them melt into the deepening sky above on their leap. A long-legged plover wandered through the clearing, picking at the ground for seeds and chirping, a high metallic sound like a small bell struck with a hammer. In a little while the smaller dragons returned, carrying the limp bodies of several antelope. Two of these were respectfully deposited before the red-brown dragon, who tore into them with appetite. Another they shared amongst themselves, and the last was given to the men, butchered quickly, and put into a large cauldron already steaming. Their captors were quiet over their dinner, clustering to one side of the fire and eating from bowls with their fingers. When one of them rose to go to the boiling pot again, and the flames leapt with the sizzle of water, Lawrence glimpsed briefly Mrs. Erasmus on the other side of the fire beside the dragon, sitting bent over, a bowl in her hands, and eating steadily and calmly. Her hair had come loose from its ruthless restraints, and curved out around her face in a stiff bell shape. She had no expression at all, and her dress was torn. After their own meal, the men came over and in a handful of bowls fed them all off the remnants, a kind of grain porridge cooked in meat broth. There was not a great deal for any of them, and humiliating to have to eat with their faces bent forward into the bowl held for them, like rooting in a trough, the remnants left dripping from their chins. Lawrence closed his eyes and ate, and when Dyer would have left some broth in the bowl, said,
"You will oblige me by eating everything you can. There is no telling when they will feed us again."
"Yes, sir," Dyer said, "only they will put us back aboard, and I'm sure I will have it all up again."
"Even so," Lawrence said,
and thankfully it seemed that their captors did not mean to set out again immediately. They instead spread out woven blankets upon the ground, and carried out a long bundle from among their things. They set it down upon the blankets and undid the wrappings, and Lawrence recognized the corpse, the man whom Hobbs had shot, the one who had murdered Erasmus. They laid him out with ceremony and washed him down with water carried from the spring, then wrapped him again in the skins of the antelope lately caught. The bloody spear they set beside him, as a trophy, perhaps. One of them brought out a drum. Others took up dry sticks from the ground or began simply clapping or stamping their feet, and with their hands and voices made a chant like a single unending cry, one taking up the thread when another paused for breath. It was grown wholly dark. They were still singing. Chenery opened his eyes and looked over at Lawrence.
"How far do you suppose we have come?"
"A night and day, flying straight at a good pace, making steadily north by northeast, I think,"
Lawrence said low.
"I cannot tell more. What speed do you think he would make, the big one?"
Chenery studied the red-brown dragon and shook his head.
"Wingspan equal to his length, not too thick set. 13 knots, at a guess. If he didn't want to throw the lightweights off his pace, call it 14."
"More than 300 miles, then,"
Lawrence said, his heart sinking. 300 miles, and not a track left behind them to show the way. If Temeraire and the others could have caught them, he would have had no fear, not of this small ragtag band, but in the vastness of the continent they could disappear as easily as if they had all been killed and buried, and waste the rest of their lives imprisoned. Already they had scarcely any hope of making their way back to the Cape overland, even setting aside the great likelihood of pursuit. If they made directly westward for the coast, avoiding all native perils and managing to find food and water enough to sustain them over a more reasonable month's march, they might at last reach the ocean. Then what? A raft, perhaps, might be contrived, or a pirogue of a sort? Lawrence did not set himself up as a cook or a bligh, but he supposed he could navigate them to a port if they escaped gale and dangerous currents and bring back aid for the survivors. A great many ifs, all of them unlikely in the extreme, and sure to only grow more so the farther they were carried. And meanwhile Temeraire would certainly have come into the interior after them, searching in a panic and exposing himself to the worst sort of danger. Lawrence twisted his wrists against the ropes. They were good stuff, strong and tightly woven, and there was little yield.
"Sir," Dyer said, "I think I have my pocket knife."
Their captors were winding down their ceremony. The two small dragons were digging a hole for the burial. The pocket knife was not very sharp, and the ropes were tough. Lawrence had to saw for a long time to free one arm, the thin wooden hilt slippery in his sweating hand, and his fingers cramping around it as he tried to bend the knife against the bindings around his wrist. At last he succeeded and passed it along to Chenery. With one arm free he could work on the knots between him and Dyer.
"Quietly, Mr. Allen,"
Lawrence said on his other side. The ensign was tugging clumsily at the knots holding him to one of Catherine's midwingmen. The mound was raised and their captors were asleep before they had more than half disentangled themselves. There was a noisy groaning of hippopotami in the darkness. It sounded very nearby at times, and occasionally one of the dragons would raise a sleepy head, listening, and make a quelling growl which silenced all the night around them. They worked more urgently now, and those of them already freed risked creeping from their places to help the others. Lawrence worked with Catherine, whose slim fingers made quick work of the worst knots, and then he whispered softly when they had loosed her man Peck, the last.
"Pray take the others into the woods, and do not wait for me. I must try and free Mrs. Erasmus."
She nodded and pressed the pocket knife on him, dulled to uselessness, but at least a moral support. And then they quietly, one by one, crept into the forest, away from the camp, except for Ferris, who crawled over to Lawrence's side.
"The guns?"
he asked softly. Lawrence shook his head. The rifles had unhappily been bundled away by their captors into the rest of their baggage, which lay tucked beside the head of one of the snoring dragons. There was no way to get at them. It was dreadful enough to have to creep past the sleeping men, lying exhausted and sprawled upon the ground after the catharsis of their wake. Every ordinary snuffled noise of sleep magnified 100-fold, and the occasional low crackles of the fire burning down like thunderclaps. His knees were inclined to be weak, and some of his steps sagged involuntarily, almost so they brushed the ground. He had to steady himself with a hand against the dirt. Mrs. Erasmus was lying apart from the men, to one side of the fire, very near the head of the great red-brown dragon. His forelegs were curled shallowly to either side of her. She was huddled very small, with her hands tucked beneath her head, but Lawrence was glad to see she did not seem to have been injured. She jerked almost loose when Lawrence's hand came over her mouth, the whites of her eyes showing all around, but her trembling quieted at once when she saw him. She nodded, and he lifted his hand away again to help her to her feet. They crept as softly away and slowly around the great taloned claw, the black horny edges serrated and gleaming with the red firelight, the dragon's breath coming deep and evenly. His nostrils flared in their regular pace, showing a little pink within. They were 10 paces away, 11. The dark eyelid cracked, and the yellow eye slid open upon them. He was up and roaring at once.
"Go!"
Lawrence shouted, pushing Mrs. Erasmus onward with Ferris. His own legs would not answer quickly, and one of the men, waking, leapt upon him, taking him by the knees and to the ground. They fell wrestling in the dust and dirt near the fire, Lawrence grimly hoping for nothing more now than to cover the escape. It was a clumsy, drunken struggle, like the last rounds of a mill, with both parties weaving and blooded, both of them exhausted, and Lawrence's weakness matched by his opponent's confusion of having been woken from sound sleep. Rolling upon his back, Lawrence managed to lock an arm around the man's throat, and pulled with all his might upon his own wrist to hold it. He lashed out with his booted foot to trip another who was snatching for his spear. Ferris had pushed Mrs. Erasmus towards the forest. A dozen of the aviators were running out to come to her aid and to Lawrence.
"Lift her more!"
the dragon cried. Whatever the threat or meaning, it brought her to a distracted halt, looking around. The dragon was lunging for Ferris. She called out in protest herself, and running back where Ferris had dived to the ground to evade in desperation, threw herself between, holding up a hand. The claw, descending, stopped, and the dragon put it down again before her. This time the men set a watch, learning from their mistake, and tied them up closer by the fire. There would be no second attempt. The two small dragons had herded them back to the camp with contemptuous ease and an air of practice. If in the process they had also stampeded a small herd of antelope, they did not mind that, and made a late supper to console themselves for the effort. They missed only Kettering, one of Harcourt's riflemen, and Peck and Bales, both harness men, but the latter two stumbled demoralized back into camp and surrendered early in the morning, with the intelligence that Kettering had been killed trying to ford the river by a hippo. Their pale and nauseated expressions precluded any wish of knowing more.
"It was my name," Mrs. Erasmus said, her hands tight around her cup of dark red tea. "Lethabo. It was my name when I was a girl."
She had not been permitted to come and speak to them, but at her pleading they had at length consented to bring Lawrence over, hobbled at the ankles with his wrists tied together before him, and one of the spearmen standing watch lest he try to reach towards her. The red-brown dragon himself was bent over their conversation alertly, with a malevolent eye on Lawrence at every moment.
"Are these men of your native tribe, then?" he asked.
"The men, no. They are of a tribe, I think, cousins to my own, or allied. I am not very sure, but they can understand me when I speak. But—" she paused and said, "I do not understand it properly myself, but Kafense," she nodded towards the great hovering beast, "says he is my great-grandfather."
Lawrence was baffled and supposed she had misunderstood, or translated wrong.
"No," she said, "no. There are many words I do not remember well, but I was taken with many others, and some of us were sold together also. We called all the older men grandfather for respect. I am sure that is all it means."
"Have you enough of the tongue to explain to him we meant no harm?" Lawrence asked. "That we only sought the mushrooms?"
She made the halting attempt, but the dragon snorted in a disdainful manner before she had even finished. He at once insinuated his great taloned forehand between them, glaring as if Lawrence had offered her an insult, and spoke to the men. They at once pulled Lawrence to his feet and dragged him back to the line of prisoners.
"Well," Chenery said, when Lawrence had been tied up with them again, "it sounds a little promising. I dare say when she has had a chance to talk to him, she will be able to bring him round. And in the meantime, at least they do not mean to kill us, or expect they would have done so already and saved themselves the trouble of our keep."
For what motive they had been preserved, however, was quite unclear. There was no attempt made to question them, and Lawrence was growing bewildered as their journey extended further and further, past what could ever have been the reasonable extent of the territory of a small tribe, even one in the possession of dragons. He might have thought they were circling about, to lose pursuit, but the sun during the day and the Southern Cross at night gave it the lie. Their course was steady and purposeful, always north by northeast, veering only to bring them to a more comfortable situation for the night or to running water. Early the next day they stopped by a wide river, looking almost orange from its muddy bottom, and populated by more of the noisy hippopotami, which darted away through the water with surprising speed from the pouncing dragons, submerging through wide ripples to evade. At last one of them was served out, by the two small dragons cornering it from both sides, and laid down to be butchered in the clearing. Their captors had grown confident enough to untie a few of them to assist with the tedious labour. Dire and Catherine's young runner, Took, set to carrying water back and forth in a bowl, fetching it uneasily from the water's edge. There was a substantial crocodile sleeping on the farther bank, whose green eye was wide open and fixed upon them. Its flesh was evidently not a temptation to the dragons, for it showed not the least sign of fear. The dragons lay drowsing in the sun, their tails flicking idly at the enormous clouds of flies which gathered round them, their heads pillowed on their forelegs. Mrs. Erasmus was speaking into Kefense's ear. Mid-sentence he reared abruptly up and began to make questions of her demandingly. She flinched back and only shook her head, refusing. At last he left off, and cast his eyes southward, sitting up on his haunches like a coat of arms. A dragon, sedient, erect, gules. Then slowly he settled himself back down. He spoke to her once more and pointedly shut his eyes.
"Well, I don't suppose we need ask what he thinks of letting you go," Chenery said, when she had crept around to them.
"No," she said, speaking low to keep from rousing the dragons up again. "And matters are only worse. I spoke of my daughters, and now Kefense wants nothing more than to go back for them also."
Lawrence was ashamed to feel an eager leap of hope at a situation which naturally could cause her only the greatest anxiety, but such an attempt would at least reveal to the rest of the formation the identity of their captors.
"And I assure you, ma'am," he said, "that any such demand would be received with the utmost scorn. I am confident that our fellow officers and General Grey will consider your children their own charge."
"Captain, you do not understand," she said. "I think he would be ready to attack all the colony to get at them. He thinks there may be more of their stolen kindred there, too, among the slaves."
"I am sure I wish them much luck if they like to try it," Chenery said. "Pray don't be worried for the girls. Even if these fellows have another few beauties like this grandfather of yours at home, it will take a little more than that to crack a nut like the castle. There are 24-pounders there, not to speak of pepper-guns, and a full formation. I don't suppose he would like to come back with us instead, to England, I mean," he added, with a flash of cheerful optimism. "If he has taken to you so strong, you ought to be able to persuade him."
But it was very soon clear that Kefense, whatever else he meant by calling himself her great-grandfather, certainly considered himself in the light of her elder, even though she thought now that she vaguely recalled his hatching.
"Not well, but I am almost sure of it," she said. "I was very young, but there were many days of feasting and presents, and I remember him often in the village after,"
which Lawrence supposed answered for her lack of fear of dragons. She had been taken as a girl of some 9 years' age, old enough to have lost the instinctive terror. Remembering her only as a child, Kefense, far from being inclined to obey, had instead concluded from her efforts to secure their freedom that she was their dupe, either frightened or tricked into lying for their sake, and he was grown all the angrier for it.
"I beg you do not risk any further attempts at persuasion," Lawrence said. "We must be grateful for his protection of you. I would have you make no more fruitless attempts, which might cause him to reconsider his sentiments."
"He would do nothing to hurt me," she said,
a strange certainty, perhaps the restoration of some childhood confidence. Having breakfasted on roasted hippo, they flew on some hours more, and landed again only a little while before dark, beside what seemed to be a small farming village. The clearing where they descended was full of children at play, who shrieked with delight at their arrival, and ran eagerly around the dragons, chattering away at them without the slightest evidence of fear, although they peered very nervously at the prisoners. A broad, spreading mimosa tree stood at the far end of the clearing, giving pleasant shade, and beneath it stood an odd little shed with no front, raised several feet from the ground, and housing within it a dragon egg of substantial size. Around it a circle of women sat with mortar and pestle, pounding grain. They put aside their tools and patted the dragon egg as if speaking to it, and rose to greet the visitors as they leapt down from the smaller dragons' backs, and to stare with curiosity. Several men came in from the village to clasp arms with the handlers and greet the dragons. An elaborately carved elephant's tooth hung from a tree, the narrow end cut open to make a horn, and one of the villagers took this down and blew on it, several long, hollow, ringing blasts. Shortly another dragon landed in the clearing, a middle weight of perhaps 10 tons, a delicate dusty shade of green with yellow markings and sprays of red spots upon his breast and shoulders, and 2 sets of long foreteeth which protruded over his jaw above and below. The children were even less shy of this newcomer, clustering close about his forelegs, even climbing upon his tail and pulling on his wings, a treatment which he bore with perfect patience while he talked with the visiting dragons. The 4 of them settled around the enshrined dragon egg in company with their handlers and the men of the village, and one older woman also sat with them, her dress marking her apart, a skirt of animal skins and strings of long beads like reed joints, and many heaped necklaces of animal claws and coloured beads also. The rest of the women brought a large steaming pot of porridge, the grain boiled up in milk rather than broth for their dinner, with fresh greens cooked with garlic and dried meat preserved in salt, a little tough but flavourful, vinegary and spiced. Bowls were brought for the prisoners, and their hands were untied to allow them to eat for themselves for once, their captors less weary with so large a company around them, and in the celebratory bustle Mrs. Erasmus was able to slip away from Cafensi to join them once again. He had been given pride of place beside the dragon egg, and presented a large cow to eat, and they seemed to hold the evening's entertainment until he had finished. At least when the remnants of the carcass on which he feasted had been carried away, and fresh dirt scattered over the ground before him to soak up the blood, only then did the old woman stand up, the one oddly dressed, and coming to stand before the dragon egg began to sing and clap. The audience took up the rhythm with clapping and with drums, and their voices joined with her on the refrains. Each verse was different, without rhyme or pattern that Lawrence could see.
"She is saying... she is telling the egg," Mrs. Erasmus said, staring at the ground, unseeing, intent upon following the words. "She is telling him of his life. She is saying he was a founder of the village. He brought them to a good, safe country, past the desert, where the kidnappers do not come. He was a great hunter, and killed the lion with his own hands, when it would have raided among the cattle. They miss his wisdom in the council, and he must hurry up and come back to them. It is his duty."
Lawrence stared, entirely baffled. The old priestess had finished her own verses and began to lead one after another some of the men of the village to stand in front of the egg and recite, with a little prompting assistance from her.
"They say they are his sons," Mrs. Erasmus said, "telling him they long to hear his voice again. That is his grandson, born since his death,"
when one of them carried an infant in swaddling to the egg to pat its small hand against the shell.
"It is only some heathen superstition, of course," Mrs. Erasmus added, but uneasily.
The dragons joined their own voices to the ceremony, the local beast addressing the egg as his old friend, whose return was eagerly awaited. The smaller dragons of the distant border spoke of the general pleasures of the hunt, of taking wing, of seeing their descendants prosper. Gefensi was silent until the priestess chided him and coaxed. Then at last, in his deep voice, he gave warning rather than encouragement, and spoke of grief at failing in his duty, of coming back to the deserted village, the smoke of dying fires, all the houses empty, his children lying in the dust, still and not answering his calls, and the hyena slinking through the herds.
"He searched and searched until he came to the shore, and at the ocean he knew he would not find us,"
Mrs. Erasmus said, and Cafense put his head down and moaned very low. Abruptly she rose and crossed the clearing to him, and put her hands upon his lowered muzzle. There was a certain sluggishness to the next morning's preparations for departure, the dragons and men both having indulged in some brewed liquor late in the evening's festivities, which now rendered them all dragging. The small green dragon yawned and yawned as if he would unhinge his jaw. Woven baskets were being brought out to the clearing, so large they required 2 men each to carry,
and full of foodstuffs. Small, pale, yellow kidney beans, spotted black, hard and dried. Red-brown grains of sorghum. Small onions of yellow and purple-red. More strips of the pungent, dried meat. The men of their party nodded over the tribute, and the baskets were covered with woven lids, tied securely on with strips of tough, thin rope braided of bark. The baskets in pairs were slung over the necks of the smaller dragons, who bent their heads to receive them. There was at all times a watchful guard upon them, however, and also upon the perimeters of the village. Younger boys with a large cowbell sort of contraption which they could have rung out in an instant. It was a shameful consequence of the rapacity of the slave trade that, having exhausted the natural supply of prisoners of war among the kingdoms of the coast, the native suppliers of the trade had turned to kidnapping and raiding, without even the thin excuse of a quarrel over territory, solely to acquire more human chattel. These efforts were extending further into the interior with every year, and had evidently made the villagers begin to be wary. It was not a condition of long standing, for the village was not designed upon defensible lines, being only a collection of handsome but small, low houses made of clay and stones, and roofed in straw. These were circular, with nearly a quarter of the circumference open to the elements to let the smoke of their cooking fires out, and would have offered little shelter against a marauding band intent on capture or slaughter. Indeed, there was no great wealth here, which they should have studied to protect, only a small herd of cattle and goats browsing idly beyond the village boundaries under the attention of a few older children, respectable fields adequate for subsistence, and a little more. A few of the women and older men wore handsome trinkets of ivory and gold and brightly woven cloth, but nothing which would have tempted the rapacity of an ordinary robber, save the inhabitants themselves, for their being peaceful, healthy, and well-fleshed, and the caution sat new and uneasily upon their shoulders.
"They have had no one stolen here yet," Mrs. Erasmus said, "but three children were snatched from a village a day's flight from here. One was hiding nearby, and slipped away to give the warning. So the ancestors, the dragons, caught them."
She paused, and said, oddly calm,
"That is why the slave-takers killed all my family, I think. The ones too old or too young to sell, so they could not tell Kavensi where we had gone."
She stood up and went to go stand watching the village, while the packing went forward. The smallest children at play before their grandmothers, the other women working together, pounding flour out of sorghum and singing. Her dark, high-collared dress was dusty and torn, incongruous among their bright, if immodest, garments, and Kafensi lifted his head to watch her with anxious, jealous attention.
"He must have gone half mad," Chenery said to Lawrence in an undertone, "as though his captain and all his crew were gone in an instant."
He shook his head.
"This is a kettle and no mistake. He will never let her go."
"Perhaps she may find an opportunity to slip away,"
Lawrence said grimly. He reproached himself bitterly that they had ever involved her and Erasmus at all. For another day and night they did not stop again, except very briefly for water, and Lawrence's heart sank at the vast expanse of hard, dry desert which rolled away below them, a succession of red-brown sands and arid scrubland, and great white salt-pans barren of all life. Their course continued northeast, bearing them still farther inland and away from the coast, their thin hopes of escape or rescue wasting away entirely. At last they left behind the wastelands, and the desert yielded to milder scenery of green trees and yellow ground overgrown with thick grasses. Late in the morning the belly of the dragon rumbled loud above them with his roar of greeting, answered momentarily with several voices from up ahead, and they came abruptly into view of an astonishing prospect. A vast, moving herd of elephants creeping slowly across the savannah as they tore at the shrubs and low-hanging branches in their path, and enduring with perfect docility the supervision of two dragons and some 30 men who ambled along comfortably behind, only a few lengths short of the rear of the herd. The herdsmen carried long sticks with dangling rattles, by which means they kept the herd from turning back. A little farther along, perhaps a quarter of a mile into the wreckage the herd had left behind, women worked busily, spreading great bushels of red-stained manure and planting young shrubs. They sang as they worked, rhythmically. The prisoners were let down.
Lawrence almost was distracted from the waterbag for staring at the fat, sluggish creatures larger than any he had ever heard bragged of. He had visited India twice as a naval officer, and once seen an impressive old creature carrying a native potentate and his retinue upon its head, some 6 tons in weight. The most impressive here would have, he guessed, outweighed that one by half again, and rivalled Nitidus or Dulcia in size, with great ivory tusks jutting out like spears some 3 feet beyond its head. Another of the behemoths put its head down against a young tree of no mean size, and with a groaning, implacable push brought it crashing to the ground. Pleased with its success, the elephant ambled lazily down its length to devour at leisure the tender shoots from the crown. After some little conversation with their captors, the herd dragons went aloft and shivered away a few of the beasts from the main body of the herd, older animals by the length of their tusks, without young. These having been coaxed downwind and behind the line of herdsmen, Kafensi and the 2 other dragons fell upon them skilfully. A single piercing of talons slew the creatures before they could make any outcry which might have distressed the rest. The dragons made their repast greedily, murmuring with satisfaction, as might a contented gentleman over his pleasing dinner. When they were done, the hyenas crept out of the grass to deal with the bloody remains, and cackled all through the night. Throughout the next 2 days they were scarcely an hour aloft without sight of some other dragons calling greetings from afar. More villages flashed past beneath them, and occasionally some small fortification with walls of clay and rock, until in the distance they glimpsed a tremendous plume of smoke rising, like a great grass fire, and a thin silvery line winding away over the earth. Mosi Oatonya, Mrs. Erasmus had told them, was the name of their destination, meaning smoke that thunders, and a low and continuous roaring built higher around them as Kafensi angled directly towards the plume. The narrow, shining line upon the earth resolved itself swiftly into a river of great immensity, slow and very broad, fractured into many smaller streams, all winding together past rocks and small grassy islets, towards a narrow crack in the earth, like an eggshell broken down the middle, where the river suddenly boiled up and plunged into the thunder of a waterfall more vast than anything Lawrence might have conceived, the gorges of its descent so full of white-plumed spray that its base could not be seen. Into these narrow gorges, which seemed barely wide enough for him to go abreast, Kafensi dived at speed, pocket rainbows gleaming in puddles collected upon his hide through the first clouds of steam. Pressed hard up against the netting, Lawrence wiped water from his face and 1 week's beard, and palmed it away from the hollows of his eyes, squinting as they broke through into a widening canyon. The lower slopes were thickly forested, a jewel-green tangle of tropical growth reaching some halfway up the walls, where abruptly the vegetation ended and the cliff faces rose sheer and smooth to the plain above, gleaming like polished marble and pockmarked only by the gaping holes of caverns. And then Lawrence realized he was not looking at caverns, but at great carved archways, mouths for vaulted halls which penetrated deep within the mountainside. The cliff walls did not gleam like polished marble, they were polished marble, or as good as. A smooth, speckled stone with quantities of ivory and gold inlaid directly into the rock in fantastical pattern. Facades were carved and sculpted around the openings, ornamented gorgeously in vivid colour and odd abstract patterns, and towering more vast than Westminster or St. Paul's, the only and inadequate measures of comparison which Lawrence possessed. Narrow stairs, their railings carved of stone and smoothed by the water spray, climbed between the archways to give the perspective. 5 ordinary townhouses, laid foundation to roof atop one another, might have approximated the heights of the largest. Kafensi was going at a lazy speed now, the better to avoid collision. The gorge was full of dragons. Dragons flew back and forth busily among the halls, some carrying baskets or bundles, some carrying men on their backs. Dragons lay sleeping upon the carved ledges, tails drooping downward from the mouths. Upon the stairways and in the halls men and women stood talking or at labour, dressed in animal skins or wrapped cloth garments of dazzling bright colours, indigo and red and yellow ochre against their dark brown skin, many with elaborate chains of gold. And softly running above the sounds of all their mingled speech came the unending voice of the water.
Chapter 11 Kefensi deposited them rudely within one of the smaller caverns dug into the face of the rock. He could not fit inside himself, but only balanced upon the lip of the cave while the netting was undone. They were shaken out onto the floor in a heap, still tied up, and he flew at once away, taking poor Mrs. Erasmus with him, and abandoning them to work themselves loose. There was no sharp edge to help them. The cavern walls were smoothed. Dyer and Roland and Took managed eventually to squirm their smaller hands out of their bindings and began to help untie the others. 30 of them left altogether, from 4 crews. They were not crowded, nor could their circumstances be called cruel. The floor was strewn liberally with dry straw to soften the hard rock, and despite the lingering day's heat outside, the chamber remained cool and pleasant. A necessary pit was carved out of the stone at the back of the chamber. It must surely have connected with a drainage channel somewhere beneath, but the opening was small and drilled through solid rock. There was no way to get to it. There was a small pool also in the back, refreshed continuously from a trickling channel, and waist-deep on a man, large enough to swim across a few strokes. They would by no means die of thirst. It was a strange prison, with neither guard nor bars upon the door, but as impregnable as any fortress. There were none of the carved steps leading to their cavern, and nothing but the yawning gorge beneath. The scale of the hole, the carved and gothic ceiling vaulting overhead, would have made a comfortable stall for a small dragon. It ought to have seemed an airy and spacious environment, but had the effect of making them feel rather Lilliputian than comfortable. Children wandering in a giant's house, with their numbers so painfully small and dwindled. Dorset was alive, with a terrible bruising down along the side of his face, and he pressed his hand now and again to his side, as if his ribs or his breathing pained him.
"Mr. Pratt is dead, Captain," he said. "I'm very sorry, to be sure. He tried to stand before Mrs. Erasmus, and the beast carved him to the hip."
A grievous loss, the smith's quiet capability, no less than his immense strength. There was no way to be certain of the full extent of their losses. Hobbs killed before their eyes, and Lawrence had seen Chenery's midwingman Hyatt dead. Chenery's lieutenant Libley remembered the surgeon Whaley fallen also, but another dozen at least had been heaved out after that first night, the rest of them too sick and dazed to recognize in dim lighting, and more had been left dead upon the field. Others still, they hoped, had slipped away in the general confusion, to leave at least some faint direction behind. There was no one who had seen Warren.
"But I hope to God that Sutton will have the sense to turn back straight away for the Cape," Harcourt said. "No one could ever conceive we had been brought so far. They will wear themselves to rags with fretting and never find a trace. We must find some way to get them word, at least. Those men knew something about guns, did you notice? There must be some trade, some merchants must be tempted to come, more ivory than they know what to do with, when they build their walls out of the stuff."
They ventured cautiously to the edge of the cavern mouth to look out again into the gorges. The first impression of immensity and splendour was not to be undone, but the degree perhaps fell off a little here, farther from the falls, and near the end of the inhabited portion of the gorges. The façade of their own prison was plain rock, although the native cliff wall had been polished to a smoothness that would have defied a monkey to climb. Chenery bent down over the ledge and rubbed his hand over the wall as far down as he could reach, and came up discouraged.
"Not a finger hold to be had. We're not going anywhere, until we manage to sprout wings of our own." "Then we had better rest, while we may," Harcourt said in practical tones, "and if you gentlemen will be so good as to give me your backs, I am going to bathe."
They were roused up early, not by any attentions paid to them, for there were none, but by a dreadful noise which could most easily be compared to a swarm of horse-flies in continuous agitation. The sun had not yet penetrated into the twisting canyons, though the sky above was the thorough-going blue of mid-morning, and a faint glaze of mist yet clung to the smooth rock near the cavern mouth. Across the gorge a pair of dragons were engaged in a peculiar exercise, flying back and forth, hauling alternately upon what looked to be a thick grey hawser coiled about, and passed through the end of a tremendous iron shaft, spinning it steadily. The other end of the shaft was plunged into the depths of a cavern only partially hollowed out, and from here issued the malevolent buzzing. Dust and chalky powder blew out in great gusts, speckling the dragon's hides so they were coated thickly ochre. Occasionally one or the other would turn his head and sneeze powerfully without ever losing the rhythm. A great cracking noise heralded a leap forward. Loose pebbles and great stones came spilling from the mouth of the hall into a large sack stretched out upon a frame to catch them. The dragons paused in their labour and withdrew the enormous drill. One clung on to the rough, unpolished cliff, holding the mechanism suspended, while the other perched upon the ledge and scraped out the boulders and loose rock which had shattered. A third dragon, smaller, came winging down the gorge when the operation was complete. He carried away the laden sack to let the pair resume. While this work proceeded, almost directly above them, another cavern, already sunk deep within the hillside, crawled with human masons finishing the rough work. The distant, musical plink-plink of tapping hammers on the rock drifting across the divide. Each man bringing his own discards to the cave mouth as they smoothed down the walls. They were very industrious all the morning. Then, midday arriving, they quitted their work. Their tools were heaped inside the cavern, the vast drill also, and the dragons flying up collected the men, who without any harness leapt with casual fearlessness onto the dragons' backs, wings, limbs, and clapped onto the handful of woven straps, or merely clung, and were borne away along the gorge back to the more settled area. Still no one had come. They had among their pockets some biscuit, a little dried fruit, which would not have made a meal for even one man. It was pressed on Catherine, who at first disdained it scornfully, until Dorset insisted upon it as a medical matter. The workmen did not return, but several dragons appeared in a party upon the plain on the far side of the gorge, each carrying a goodly-sized bundle of wood, and laid down a large bonfire. Then one among them bent its head and breathed out a flame, igniting the whole. It was not perhaps a great stream of fire, but then none was called for by the circumstances.
"Oh, that is a pity," Chenery said rather low, understating the case.
They grew only sorrier when another pair arrived, carrying what looked to be the component parts of three or four elephants among them, butchered and neatly skewered on long iron stakes to roast over the bonfire. The wind was in their quarter, carrying towards the caves. Lawrence had to wipe his mouth with his handkerchief twice. Even the very back of the cavern offered no shelter from the torment of the delicious smell. It was very disheartening to observe the dragons cast away the scorched and cracked bones when they had done, into the massive thicket of jungle which lined the floor of the gorge below. Still more regrettable were the satisfied growls and yelping which presently rose up in reply, lions, perhaps, or wild dogs, a fresh obstacle to any escape. 2 hours more passed, or nearly, by the cracked glass which Turner had managed to salvage from the wreck of their capture. It began to grow dark. Dragons came flying to many of the plain cave mouths nearby, carrying netting full of men, whom they let down inside the caves just as the aviators had been deposited. The dragons had a sort of trick of setting their hind legs upon the lip of each cavern, and setting their four claws into some ridges carved above the mouth, while their riders unhooked the netting, so they did not have to squeeze into some of these smaller caverns. It bore some resemblance to the passenger dragons, which Lawrence had seen in China, save for the perfect disregard for the comfort of the passengers in the nets. When these deliveries had finished, a small dragon flew down the gorge towards them with many baskets slung over its shoulders. It halted in sequence at the cave mouths, leaving behind a few of the bundles every time until at last it reached their own. There was a single man upon its back who looked their number over with a critical eye, then untied some three of the baskets before taking wing again. Each held a cold and thickened mass of sorghum porridge cooked in milk, filling, if not savoury, and the portions not quite so large as desirable.
"One basket for every 10 men, Harcourt said, counting cave mouths. "So as many as 50 men in that large one. They must have near 1,000 prisoners here spread out."
"A regular Newgate," Chenery said, "but less damp, for which be thanked. Do you suppose they mean to sell us? A charming solution if we could get ourselves shipped to Cape Coast and not a French port. And if they were not unpleasant about it—"
"Maybe they will eat us," Dyer said thoughtfully, his piping voice quite clear. All the other men were engaged deeply with their dinners.
There was a general pause.
"A thoroughly morbid suggestion, Mr. Dyer. Let me hear no more of this sort of speculation," Lawrence said, taken aback.
"Oh, yes, sir,"
Dyer said, surprised, and went directly back to his dinner, with no particular sign of dismay. Some of the younger ensigns looked greenly, and it required perhaps a full minute
before hunger once again overcame their temporary qualms. The line of sunlight crept up the far wall and slid away over the edge. Dusk came early into the narrow gorge. For lack of anything else to do, they slept, while the sky above was still a day-lit blue, and the next morning roused from an uneasy night into darkness, with a dreadful buzzing of the drill suddenly muffled. Dyer's breathless, "Sir, sir!" in Lawrence's ear. Kafensi was there. He had thrust as much of his head as would fit into the opening of their cavern, blocking both light and noise from outside. Mrs. Erasmus was with him, difficult to recognise in the native dress which she had been given, and weighted down as if she were in danger of floating away. Earrings, armbands like coiled snakes on upper arms and lower, a great neck collar of gold pieces strung on wire, interspersed with pieces of ivory, dark green jade and ruby, certainly worth £50,000 at least, and a great emerald like an egg set in gold, pinning a turban of silk upon her head. Most of the native women which they had seen from their vantage point had been carrying water, or hanging washing to dry upon the steps, and wore only a kind of leather skirt, reaching to the knees but leaving their breasts quite bare, much to the covert interest of the younger officers. Perhaps formal garments were of different style, or she had prevailed upon them to give her others. She wore instead a long skirt of plain white cotton, and over it another length of cotton cloth woven of bright colours, wrapped and folded elaborately about her shoulders. She required the assistance of a hand on her elbow to climb down from Kafensi's back.
"They would have me wear more if it would not make it impossible for me to walk. It is the tribal property," she said.
It was evasion. Her expression was uneasy, and after a moment's pause she said, low,
"I am sorry. Kafensi is here to take our leader to go and speak with the king."
Harcourt was pale but composed.
"I am senior, ma'am. He may take me."
"He may sooner go to the devil," Chenery said. "Lawrence, shall we have lots for it?"
Taking up a small twig from the rushes, he snapped it in two and held them out with the top ends even, the lower concealed. It was at least a good deal more comfortable to be carried in Kafensi's talons than in the former netting, and Lawrence did not feel his appearance wholly disgraceful. The idleness and heat of the day had left them nothing but time, and thanks to the convenience of the water pool, he had sponged his coat as best he could, and thoroughly washed his breeches and his linen. He had not shaved, but that could not be helped. The roar of the falls increased steadily, and the tangle of jungle below, until they were brought at last to a curve of the gorge very near the falls. Here a great hall stood open, three times the width of the other archways, the entryway pillared for support. Kafensi dived low and swiftly within, and coming to a stop, rolled him unceremoniously out of his talons onto the damp floor, before more carefully setting Mrs. Erasmus onto her feet. Lawrence had already come to expect these indignities, and picked himself up without more than irritation, an emotion promptly vanquished in favour of concern. A makeshift workshop had been established recently, it seemed, along the right side of the chamber, and besides the rifles which the aviators themselves had lost, some 60 or 70 muskets more were laid out upon the floor on woven mats, in various states of disassembly and repair. And worse, far worse, a 6-pound gun, its housing cracked but not gone, and a barrel of gunpowder besides. A small group of men were working upon the collection, taking apart a musket and pressing low, harsh questions on a man sitting dejectedly on a stool before them. His back, turned to Lawrence, was marked with half a dozen bloody wheels, and flies crawled upon it. A young man was overseeing their work with great attention. He left off as Kafensi landed and came over towards them. Tall, with a long face infused with a certain quality of sorrow, not by emotion, but only the angle of his cheekbones, like a hound, the nose sculpted and a narrow black beard around the full mouth. He had a small escort of warriors, all of them bare-chested and armed with short spears, leather-skirted. He was distinguished from the rest of them by a thick neck-collar of gold with a fringe of what looked to be the claws of some great cat, and a leopard-skin cape draped over the shoulders, physically powerful, and his eyes were shrewd. Lawrence bowed. The young man ignored him, looking to the other side of the great hall, and from a chamber within came a great creature of golden bronze hide, the underside of her wings lined in purple like royalty.
She was in battle array, formidable as a crusader, great heavy plates of iron slung across the vulnerable expanse of her breast, with a fine mesh of chain beneath to protect the belly, and the spikes bristling down her spine were sheathed in caps of iron, as were her talons, and these were yet discoloured a little with blood. Mrs. Erasmus gave him to understand that this was the king, Mokachane, and his eldest son, Moshweshwe. She, or he? Lawrence was at a loss. He was standing scarcely half a length away, and the king was quite certainly, quite visibly a female dragon, seated herself sphinx-like on the floor, her tail curling along her flanks, and regarded Lawrence with a cold and amber eye. The young man, Moshweshwe, seated himself on a wooden throne which was brought to him and set by her side, and several older women trailing after settled themselves on wooden stools behind him, these identified as the king's wives. Kafensi lowered his head respectfully, and began to speak, evidently giving his account of their capture and journey, which Mrs. Erasmus, with great courage, dared to dispute at several points on their behalf, while trying to help Lawrence understand the accusations which had been made. That they had stolen medicines, cultivated for the use of the king's own subjects, was only the least offence. The foremost, that they had offered a territorial challenge by invading in the company of their own ancestors, as Kafensi considered the dragons of the formation to be, and in league with enemy tribes had been stealing their children, for which he offered as one portion of evidence that they had been travelling with a man of the Lunda, notorious kidnappers. Mrs. Erasmus paused and said unevenly,
"He means my husband."
She did not continue her translation at once, but pressed a fold of her gown briefly to her face, while Kafensi bent low and anxiously over her, crooning and snapping at Lawrence with a hiss, when he would have offered his arm for her support.
"The medicine we took only for necessity, because our own dragons were ill, and without knowing the mushroom cultivated," Lawrence said.
But he did not know how else to defend himself. He could not very well deny they had brought dragons. They had, and in any case this seemed rather to stand in for making a territorial claim, which he could certainly not, as a serving officer, deny. The British and the Dutch would alike have been surprised to know their colony had been thought unworthy of notice and casually to be violated until the arrival of the formation. And he was in no fair way armed to justify the practice of slavery, or to deny that it was carried on at the behest of white men, if he might refute some few of the particulars which were levelled against them.
"No, good God, of course we do not eat them," he said,
but beyond this could make very little more argument. The dreadful incident of the Zong, where more than 100 slaves had been deliberately flung overboard for the sake of insurance money, chose the moment to come uncomfortably to his mind, with a blush for the guilt and shame of his nation, made him look a liar, if they had not already thought him so. He could only repeat that he was not himself a slaver, and was not surprised to find this excuse hold no water with them, nor even when Mrs. Erasmus had explained to them her husband's perfect innocence. The objection plainly was wider than such personal acts. There was no sympathy offered for the illness which had driven them to seek the medicine. Lawrence rather received the impression that they thought it little more than just deserts, drawing as they did no particular distinction between the British and their dragons, and their temper grew rather more fixed than less for all Lawrence's attempts to explain. The king turned, and in response to a beckoning flick of her tail, Lawrence was led farther back into the chamber, where stood a low table of enormous size, no higher than his knee, but some 12 feet long and across. The women folded away the wooden covers, and a hollow space, perhaps a foot deep, was revealed, like a sort of display case. Inside lay a strange sculpture in the shape of the African continent. It was a map, an enormous map in thick relief to show elevation, gold dust for sand, and mountains of bronze, jewel-chip forests, and rivers of silver, and with great dismay Lawrence perceived the puff of white feather-down used to stand for the falls. It stood almost halfway between the tip of the continent where Cape Town lay and the sharp, jutting prominence of the African Horn. In his worst fears he had not thought they had been brought so far into the interior. They did not let him look at it long. Instead they drew him to the other end, where the table had been lately extended. The wood was darker, and the sections of the map laid down only in soft, painted wax. He did not at first know what to make of it, until by relative position he understood the blue oval stretch of water at the top of the continent must be the Mediterranean, and realized it was meant to figure as Europe, the outlines of Spain and Portugal and Italy misshapen, and the whole continent shrunk. Britain itself nothing but a scattering of small whitish lumps in the upper corner. The Alps and the Pyrenees stood in pinched-up relief, approximately correct, but the Rhine and Volga were strangely meandering and smaller than he was used to see them marked.
"They wish you to draw it properly," Mrs. Erasmus said,
and one of the prince's men handed him a stylus. Lawrence gave it back. The man repeated the instructions in his own tongue, exaggeratedly, as if Lawrence were a slow child, and attempted to press the stylus on him once more.
"I beg your pardon. I will not," Lawrence said, shaking off his hand.
The man spoke loudly and struck him abruptly across the face. Lawrence pressed his lips together and said nothing, his heart pounding in a furious temper. Mrs. Erasmus had turned to speak urgently to Cofenzi. The dragon was shaking his head.
"Having been taken prisoner in what I must consider an act of war, I must refuse under these conditions to answer any questions whatsoever," Lawrence said.
Moshweshwe shook his head, while the Dragon King lowered her head and fixed him with a glittering and furious eye, her head so close that he could see that what he had taken for tusks in Cofenzi were a kind of jewellery, ivory rings banded with gold set in the flesh of her upper lip like earrings. She snorted hot breath across his face and bared serrated teeth, but he had too much use of being so close to Temeraire to be frightened thus, and her eyes slitted down angrily as she drew her head back. The king said coldly,
"You were taken as a thief and a kidnapper in our country. You will answer all."
And Mrs. Erasmus paused and said,
"Captain, you will be flogged."
"Brutality and further ill-usage will in no wise alter my determination," Lawrence said, "and I beg your pardon, ma'am, if you are forced to witness it."
His answer provoked her only further. Moshweshwe, laying a hand on the king's foreleg, spoke in low tones, but she shivered her skin impatiently and threw him off. She spoke in a low, angry, continuous rumble, which Mrs. Erasmus could only manage piecemeal to convey.
"You speak of ill usage to us, kidnapper, invader. You will answer. We will hunt you all. We will break your ancestors' eggs."
She finished and violently cracked her tail above her back, issuing orders. Cofenzi held his forehand out to Mrs. Erasmus. She threw Lawrence one look of deep concern before she was carried briskly away, which he would have been glad to think unmerited, and then his arms were seized on either side, his coat cut away down the middle of the back, also his shirt, and he was forced to his knees with the rags still hanging from his shoulders.